This program is sponsored by the members of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. The following is a production of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. Bringing citizens and citizen soldiers together through the exploration of military history, topics, and current affairs. This is Pritzker Military Presents.
Welcome to Pritzker Military Presents for a decisive battles discussion by author Larry Ferraro on his book entitled Brothers at Arms, American Independence and the Men of France and Spain Who Saved It. I'm your host, Rob Habers, and this program is coming to you from the Pritzker Military Museum and Library in downtown Chicago and is sponsored by members of the Museum and Library. This program and hundreds more covering a full range of military topics is available on demand at PritzkerMilitary.org. Winner of the Journal of the American Revolution 2016 Book of the Year Award, this remarkable untold story of how the American Revolution's success depended on substantial military assistance provided by France and Spain places the revolution in the context of the global strategic interests of those nations in their fight against Great Britain. In this groundbreaking Pulitzer Prize finalist revisionist history, Larry Ferraro shows that at the time the first shots were fired at Lexington and Concord, the colonists had little chance, if any, of militarily defeating the British. The nascent American nation had no navy, little in the way of artillery, and a militia bereft even of gunpowder. Instead of viewing the American Revolution in isolation, Brothers at Arms reveals the birth of the American nation as the centerpiece of an international coalition fighting against a common enemy. Larry D. Ferraro received his PhD in the history of science and technology from Imperial College London. He teaches history and engineering at George Mason University in Virginia and the Stevens Institute of Technology in New Jersey. He has served for over 35 years in the United States Navy, the United States Coast Guard, and Department of Defense, and was an exchange engineer in the French Navy. He is the author of Measure of the Earth, The Enlightenment Expedition That Reshaped Our World, and Ships and Science, The Birth of Naval Architecture in the Scientific Revolution, 1600 to 1800. Please join me in welcoming Larry Ferraro to the Pritzker Military Museum and Library.
Thank you. Thank you. As you just heard, by 1776, America was fighting Britain in a war for independence, but it was doing so without a navy, without artillery, or even gunpowder. Only France and Spain, who were the historical enemies of Britain, had both the motive and the industrial strength and naval strength and military strength to defeat the British. France and Spain were our allies, and we needed them. But France and Spain would only ally with the Americans if America was not seen as simply fighting a civil war, but rather fighting as a sovereign nation. And in fact, John Adams, who was no fan of interference or intervention with other nations, said, "Foreign powers could not be expected to acknowledge us until we had acknowledged ourselves as an independent nation." Thomas Jefferson, during the debates over the Declaration of Independence, said in his notes, "A Declaration of Independence alone would allow European powers to treat for us." And that is critical because it is important to note who the Declaration of Independence was written for. It was not written for George III. He'd already gotten the memo. Back in October of 1775, he'd said before Parliament that the recent fighting at Lexington and Concord were clearly America's attempt to gain independence. So the Americans knew that George III realized this. Neither was the Declaration of Independence written for the American people. They were the ones who sent their representatives to Philadelphia to argue for and sign for a Declaration of Independence. That declaration had a very specific audience. Louis XVI of France, Carlos III of Spain. It was written for them because they wanted France and Spain to come alongside and fight with us. And that Declaration of Independence was essentially an engraved invitation. Which is why I say in my book that it was not simply the Declaration of Independence, but it was also the declaration that we depend on France and Spain as well. How did we know that France and Spain would come along in our fight? Because we knew that they wanted a rematch with Great Britain. They'd come out very badly in the Seven Years' War, which had ended in 1763 with France losing Canada, Spain losing Florida, and a lot else besides. Now, we called it the French and Indian War because as British colonists, we considered the French and their Indian nation allies to be our enemy, which played an important role during the War of American Independence. What happened then was France and Spain decided that they needed to combine their forces. Now, they were already allied by both family and military ties. It was called the Bourbon Family Compact because both the kings of France and Spain were directly descended from Louis XIV. Well, the letters between the two kings often said, "Dear uncle, dear brother." So the alliance was there not just for familial needs, but also because both France and Spain had a common enemy, Great Britain, and both of them wanted revenge. And in fact, the word revanche, which is the French word for revenge, appears in the correspondence between the two nations. They didn't want the same thing, though. France wanted to regain the balance of power in Europe. That was its rightful place. Britain had usurped it. France wanted it back. Spain wanted something quite concrete, Gibraltar. And then it wanted Gibraltar, and it wanted Gibraltar. Gibraltar was always the highest on its list because it had lost it back in the War of the Spanish Succession early in the 1700s, and it was a key piece of Spanish foreign policy. They also wanted to drive the British from Florida, which was a sore point because Spain's wealth all came from Spanish America, and it had to pass through the Gulf of Mexico. And Spain wanted the Gulf of Mexico to be a Spanish lake once more. Both these nations were spoiling for a fight. And both of them knew that they would be able to use the upcoming American Revolution in that fight against Britain. And you can see the quote from the French foreign minister, 1767, Duc de Choiseul. "Only the future American Revolution will consign England to a state of weakness." That's an important date. The French and the Spanish both knew before we did that we were going to rebel against the mother nation, and they were going to use that rebellion as part of their arsenal to defeat Britain. How did they know this? Well, they'd been sending spies and what the Spanish called observers to the Americas for some time, including Baron de Kalb and other observers from Spain, all of whom were reporting the same thing. The Americans will rebel. It may not happen soon, but it's going to happen in the near future. And in fact, when those reports came back, it was still 8 years in the offing before that rebellion would actually occur. When the fighting did begin in 1775, the British Army was being supplied with guns from factories in places like Manchester and Birmingham, which could turn out hundreds of thousands of stands of arms per year. The Americans, by contrast, only had a few hundred, maybe a couple of thousand gunsmiths across all the colonies, not all of whom were allied to the Patriot cause, and produce maybe one gun per month. So we certainly needed, at first, weapons from France and Spain, and they were coming over when the fighting began. Those arms were being provided to the Americans, even though they came from the French government and the Spanish government. They were using merchants like Diego de Gardoqui, who was in Bilbao, and Pierre Caron de Beaumarchais from France as cover, a way to hide the actual source of the shipments from the British, because neither France nor Spain wanted to get into a fight right away, certainly not before they were ready. The British, of course, were never fooled by any of this. By the time the war ended, over 90% of all the weapons that the Americans used, and about $30 billion, billion with a B, in aid, had come from overseas. Now, while the Americans were debating this Declaration of Independence, Beaumarchais was working with Silas Deane. He was the American envoy who had been sent to France to negotiate a contract for these weapons. And the contracts were finally signed between France and Deane, even as the Declaration of Independence was being debated, even before it was sent to Europe, before they even knew that it was going to be signed. So in the late part of 1776 rather, and the early part of 1777, the contract having been signed, Beaumarchais went around France, collected weapons, guns, munitions, cannon, and freighted five ships which sailed across the Atlantic. And those ships arrived in America just in time to provision American troops who had been fighting a rearguard action against Burgoyne, who'd been marching down from Canada down the Hudson Valley towards New York with the intent of cutting America between New England and the rest of the states and then destroying the rest of the colonies as they saw it in detail. The Americans were fighting a rearguard action because they did not have enough weapons to defeat them, but that all changed as the British were approaching Saratoga, because those weapons arrived just in time to furnish 15,000 troops with 20,000 muskets, hundreds of cannon, gunpowder, and that enabled the Americans to make a stand at Saratoga, and not only make a stand, but actually defeat Burgoyne, and not only defeat Burgoyne, but capture his entire army. And that rocked the British back on their heels. And you can see from the quote by Caleb Stark, who was there at the time and knew what he was talking about, unless these Beaumarchais arms had thus been timely furnished to the Americans, Burgoyne would have made an easy march to Albany. So those French arms turned the tide of the whole campaign. France had to rethink its entire strategy. It could no longer depend upon cutting America in two and destroying the Americans' colonies in detail. They had to think of something else. But that all was again rocked back by these next developments. While the muskets and cannon and munitions were coming across the ocean, so were volunteers from Europe, mostly France. And they came to fight in America, and they came to fight the British, because that was the enemy. And if you wanted to fight the enemy, you had to go to America. But along the way, they came to make the American cause their own cause. And Washington eventually came to depend upon these immigrants who got the job done, as the musical Hamilton, which is playing just a few blocks from here, I notice, said in probably one of the best lines in the entire musical. And some of those immigrants who got the job done are Louis Lebègue Duporté. He was Washington's strategist. He was Washington's engineer. He was the sounding board for a lot of Washington's ideas. And he was the one who planned the fortifications in places like Valley Forge and the sieges like Yorktown. Steuben, the baron, was really the force behind creating a training plan that changed what frankly was, up until this point, up until Valley Forge, a fairly ragtag group of militia which had been cobbled together to form an army. That training plan made that an army that could not only fight in formation, but stand toe-to-toe with the British. Finally, Lafayette, the best known of the group, was able to lead an independent command in the Southern Theater later in the war. He was the one who kept Cornwallis from coming too far north and eventually trailed him all the way to Yorktown. Now, these volunteers came, but they were not welcomed with open arms. I just mentioned that it was called the Seven Years' War, the French and Indian War. They had been the enemies a decade earlier. Now they're our allies? Even if they're volunteers, we're not so sure. Certainly, Nathanael Greene did not think so. The quote from him about these initial French volunteers, "So many spies in our camp." Well, right about this time, the British were making a concerted effort to leave New York with a contingent of troops to march on Philadelphia, the capital, invest it, invade it, and capture it. And to do that, they had to pass over the Brandywine River. And that's where George Washington made his stand against the British. And the Americans had very little to throw into that battle, so they took everything at hand, including all of these French volunteers who were, frankly, despised, and threw them into the battle. And they comported themselves quite well, as you can see from the newspaper account about the French officers showing much bravery and behaving extremely well. A few cases in point. A Polish officer, Pulaski, led a cavalry charge which saved part of the Continental Army, which was then in retreat. Fleury, one of the engineers who came over, was commended for particular bravery. And today, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, which has its origins in the French military Corps de Génie, now has the Fleury Medal, which is awarded every year, gold, silver, and bronze, for courage and boldness. And Lafayette himself was wounded during this battle. He was leading an infantry charge, managed to make it back to friendly lines. Washington commanded his doctor to treat him as if he were my own son. And that battle really changed the perception of these French volunteers from mistrust to acceptance, and then eventually into reliance. And in fact, Nathanael Greene, who called them "so many spies in our camp," came to rely on both Steuben and Lafayette during his Southern campaign some years later. Now, back at Versailles, the French foreign minister, the Comte de Vergennes, was the most important character in this whole story, because he and he alone made most of the decisions that concerned the alliance with Spain and the eventual alliance with the Americans. Now, he'd been behind all of the provisioning of the Americans with arms, behind many of the volunteers going overseas to help the Americans, and he had a very simple goal: France first. As with any alliance, it has to be in national interest. And so his goal, as had been stated by his predecessor, was to weaken the British enough so that the French could occupy again their rightful place as the center of European power, tilt the balance of power back in France's favor. And he was watching through reports firsthand and other reports the ongoing battles and seeing that the Americans, with the exception of Saratoga, were losing most of the time. And by this point, France could not afford to have Britain win and regain a position on the American continent, because that would put at risk the French colonies in the Caribbean, the sugar colonies, the sugar plantations that were the major source of wealth for France. And by the way, those colonies on adjacent islands were the major source of wealth for Britain. Caribbean was always the key. That was where all the money was. That's where everybody was really concerned. And if Britain had a reconstituted empire on the North American continent, that could put essentially at risk all of that vital part of the French Empire. It was an existential threat. So Vergennes decided, long before Saratoga, that the Americans needed France to ally directly with the Americans to bring military power and naval power directly to bear and not simply keep furnishing arms and equipment. But he was waiting for the right moment. Saratoga gave him the pretext to form the alliance that he'd already decided he was going to embark upon. And when that alliance was formed in early 1778, the very first action was that France sent a fleet over to start operating in American shores. And once again, it rocked the British back on their heels, because the key to British power, and this is going to be the story throughout the rest of this talk, was the Navy. And the fact that now France had a Navy on American shores meant that British Navy could not simply operate with impunity. It could not bring supplies across the ocean because they could not exist by foraging. They could not move troops at will back and forth in different parts of the combat theaters. The French Navy had to make them rethink their entire strategy. And in fact, they had to depart Philadelphia just months after they'd occupied it because of fear of being bottled up by the French Navy. Now, Spain, as I mentioned, was allied with France, but they could not enter the war at this point in early 1778, because at that point, Spain had a very large silver fleet that was taking silver from Peru and Mexico and bringing it back to Spain. And this was, it turned out, the last of the great treasure fleets. That treasure fleet was carrying $50 billion with a B, dollars equivalent in silver. And until that fleet was safely back in Spain, Spain could simply not risk having Britain prey upon them. And so until that fleet was home, they could not declare war on Britain. But by the end of 1778 and early 1779, when that fleet was back home, they would be able to do so. Now, Spain's foreign minister, Vergennes' counterpart, Florida Blanca, had essentially the same role as Vergennes and more or less the same strategic imperative, Spain first, of course. Now, his goals were the same as the ones previously stated: recover Gibraltar, get the British out of Florida so they could make the Gulf of Mexico a Spanish lake, and regain a few other territories besides. Well, he was foreign minister, and if he could achieve those goals without any war being fought, blood being shed, Spanish resources being expended, he would do so, of course. And so while France and Britain were fighting, Spain stepped in and made a proposal to Britain. "I will not enter the war on the side of France," said Florida Blanca through his emissaries, "and I will actually help to negotiate a peace between Spain, between France and Britain, provided you turn over Gibraltar." And Britain refused. And Florida Blanca went into one of his usual tirades. He was quite known for those. He called it "that pile of rocks, which gives them nothing except worry and expense." That's how we term Gibraltar. And yet Gibraltar was the key. For Britain, it certainly was the key, because it's a strategic outpost, it still is today, that guards the entrance to the Mediterranean coming from the Atlantic, or the Atlantic coming from the Mediterranean, and Britain would not give it up. And so Spain decided that it would go to war alongside France against Britain. And it is absolutely no exaggeration to say that Great Britain sacrificed all of America for that pile of rocks called Gibraltar. Now, Spain did not ally with the Americans. That was not part of their national interest. But they made, as a condition of British surrender, that Britain would accept American independence, because that was part of the terms of the French treaty with the Americans, which they respected. So Spain, although not allied directly with the Americans was part of that Grand Alliance. The entry of Spain into the war alongside France against Britain fundamentally changed the nature of the war from a regional conflict in North America to a global war fought at sea around the world. And if you're and the American Revolution was always going to be a naval war. Because if it's the 18th century and you're fighting Britain, it's a naval war. Britannia rules the waves, remember? Britain had a navy second to none. Had a pretty good army, but its navy was the key. Britain's navy by itself could defeat France and by itself could defeat Spain. It could not defeat France and Spain together. And the French and the Spanish had, since the ink had been drying on the treaty that ended the Seven Years' War, been creating a common naval fleet, French, Spanish, Bourbon fleet. And that Spanish and Bourbon fleet numbered 124 ships of the line. Those are the big warships that fought against Britain's 95 ships, and Britain was overwhelmed. Because not only did they have to keep fighting in North America, they also had to shield England from the threat of invasion. They had to defend the Caribbean, which again was the source of their wealth. They had to defend Gibraltar. They had to defend several other colonies. They had to defend possessions in South Africa. They had to defend possessions in India. They were spread all over the world, and they were overwhelmed. This is all happening, by the way, in 1779 and 1780, which for the Americans was really a low part of the war. And you can see that quote by Alexander Hamilton, if we are saved, France and Spain must save us. And he said that right about that point because he knew, as did the rest of the Americans, that the victory now lay in the hands of America's partners. Spain declared war in 1779, and the first action that the French and the Spanish took was to form an immense fleet of 150 ships, 30,000 men, all to invade England. This, by the way, was larger even than the famous Spanish Armada of 1588. Now, the plans for that invasion of England had been formed ever since the end of the Seven Years' War, and it involved the following. Capture Portsmouth on the south coast, capture Southampton, wreak havoc on the economy, bring Britain to the bargaining table because it was certain that with Southampton, Portsmouth, and much of the rest of the economy in Spanish and British hands, Britain would sue for peace and, among other things, give back Gibraltar. The fleet was en route when it was laid low by an attack of dysentery, which actually killed or wounded or caused sickness to about 8,000 men in this fleet. And these ships were really just hospital ships. The French admiral of the fleet was one of the first to lose somebody, his son. And that took the wind out of his sails, both metaphorically as well as physically, because they then had to beat up wind just to get into the channel. The fleet had to pull people from one ship to man another. Luis de Cordova, who was the Spanish admiral, tried to hold things together, but he couldn't, and the invasion simply fizzled out. Now, this was an existential threat to the British, and they were quite worried about it, but they weren't worried about this little sideline that happened at exactly the same point, because when the French fleet was setting sail, the French minister of the Navy asked one of the American captains who happened to be in port at the time, a little-known captain named John Paul Jones, to take a small fleet, sail around Britain, maybe attack a few ships, try to distract the British. Maybe some of the British admirals would follow him. No British admiral was foolish enough to follow John Paul Jones. It didn't cause a panic. They didn't really pay much attention to the fleet that Jones was sailing. When he finally got up around the North Sea, he happened to across a convoy of ships bringing timber back from the Baltic. So, of course, the commanding officer of the frigate, which was escorting the convoy, attacked Jones's fleet, a small fleet of just a few ships, defended the convoy. The convoy escaped, made it to port safely. Actually, the commanding officer of Serapis, that was the British ship, was knighted for his duty because he did exactly what a British captain was supposed to do, surrender his ship in battle so that the convoy could get home safely. John Paul Jones, however, managed to come alongside, grapple with Serapis. His own ship sank from under him, but he was able to capture Serapis, and eventually they brought it to the Netherlands, where the Dutch sold it off. Really, nothing in terms of any kind of strategic importance was done, but it made every single newspaper in America. 200 papers that I looked at, front page news. It was a shot in the arm. It was a moral victory for the Americans, who really, at this point in the war, needed something in this David versus Goliath battle. And that Serapis versus Bonhomme Richard was essentially the shot in the arm that the Americans needed at this point in the war. Simultaneous to all of these events, New Orleans was in the picture. And the governor of Spanish Louisiana, Bernardo de Galvez, was already supplying American troops in what was called the Western Theater. This was up and down the Mississippi all the way to Detroit. And he was giving the Americans arms, supplies, munitions. But after the Spanish declared war in 1779, he immediately began launching a series of attacks that quickly captured British outposts at Mobile, Natchez, and then Baton Rouge. And then he had his sights set on the British capital of West Florida, Pensacola. But these plans were waylaid by a series of hurricanes. In fact, some of the most devastating hurricanes in all of history. And after those hurricanes devastated not necessarily the Spanish or the French fleets, but the British fleet in the Caribbean, Galvez commanded a joint Spanish-French force that together captured Pensacola, which drove the British out of West Florida, which meant that the Gulf of Mexico was now back in Spanish hands, which meant that the British threat to the Caribbean was, at least for the time being, neutralized, which was critical. Because right at that point, a French fleet, which was intended to protect the French possessions in the Caribbean, had just arrived. And it was led by the Comte de Grasse. And his orders said, protect the French possessions in the Caribbean, the sugar plantations, but there's going to be a window between September and November, hurricane season, where you can go north and help the Americans, who by this time had an ally, the Comte de Rochambeau. They're willing to help with American land campaigns. And Comte de Grasse was given the order that he could help them during that narrow window. So Comte de Grasse was ready to go north, but he was going to leave a few of his ships behind to protect the Caribbean. The Spanish said, we will protect the Caribbean because the British are out of the picture, so we'll assign some of our ships to protect French islands, and you can take everybody. And he did. And that was the critical decision, because as de Grasse brought all of his ships up north, things were happening around the Chesapeake that would signal the beginning of the end of the war. Now, Washington and Rochambeau learned that the Comte de Grasse was coming not to New York City, which is what Washington wanted. He wanted to get New York back. But it was obvious to the experienced generals in the French army and the experienced admiral that investing New York City would have been almost impossible because of the lay of the land, the number of troops, the ability to bring a fleet into New York Harbor, which would have been almost impossible. But the Chesapeake, which by that point was home to a pretty substantial part of the British forces, was a key target. And so the Comte de Grasse sent fast frigates north saying, meet me in the Chesapeake. And Washington and Rochambeau, without skipping a beat, brought their armies on a quick march in the summer, all the way down from New York, down to the Chesapeake, and encircled, as it would turn out, Cornwallis at Yorktown. Now, the Comte de Grasse was a fighting admiral, and he was beloved by his sailors. They said of him, "The Comte de Grasse stands 6'4" and 6'5" on days of battle." Oh, and yes, since you asked, he was one of the ancestors of that rock star astrophysicist, Neil deGrasse Tyson. Now, when the Comte de Grasse met George Washington on the quarterdeck of his flagship, the Ville de Paris, and Comte de Grasse, keep in mind, towered over Washington by 2 inches, he wrapped his arms around the general and said, "Mon petit général, my little general," which is a true story. It sounds like it's fiction. And certainly no American officer would even touch Washington on the shoulder, much less embrace him. And yet, for some interesting reason, Washington always felt more at ease with his French counterparts. De Grasse was landing the troops, the munitions, the supplies around the Chesapeake when the British fleet under Thomas Graves, as they would later find out, appeared off the mouth of the Chesapeake. De Grasse quickly sortied his entire fleet and fought off Graves. Actually, he just needed to keep him out of the Chesapeake Bay. And he was able to do so because he had his entire fleet with him. Had he been a few ships short, it is absolutely uncertain whether he would have been able to keep the British out of the Chesapeake, thus sealing the fate of Cornwallis at Yorktown. So Pensacola was the battle that really was the key to Yorktown. That encirclement of Cornwallis and the fact that the British could neither resupply nor evacuate Cornwallis sealed his fate. And the story's fairly well known. After the French and American troops had a quick march all the way down to Yorktown, they encircled them. The siege began in October of 1781, just a few days it took for the guns to start blasting away. These were siege cannon, very large French siege cannon. The siege lines advanced to encircle Cornwallis, but keep in mind that the Americans had very little experience with siege warfare, so these were French officers who were directing that siege. It was French guns who were mostly conducting this, the firepower. The placement of trenches was being directed by French officers, and the French also suffered twice the casualties of the Americans. In fact, once the French and the American troops together captured redoubts 9 and 10 just outside the walls of Yorktown, the situation for Cornwallis was untenable, and the flag of surrender was waved. When a few days later, once the terms were agreed to, it was Cornwallis' second in command, the Brigadier General Charles O'Hara, who came out to offer the surrender. But he considered it a French victory. This was not the first time the British and the French had been in the field of battle. The French had won sometimes, and the French had won sometimes. This was another French victory. So he turned to Rochambeau to offer him his sword. Now, Rochambeau knew this was a French victory, but he also knew the hour, the day, the event belonged to Washington. And Rochambeau, according to the only eyewitness we have of this affair, did not say a word but gestured to Washington. So O'Hara turned to Washington and offered his sword, but Washington was not going to take the surrender from somebody else's second in command. So he gestured to his own second in command, Benjamin Lincoln. The surrender was offered, was accepted, and the Battle of Yorktown was over. That wasn't the end of the war. Certainly Vergennes understood that. You can see his quote. "It is not in the English character to give up so easily." And they didn't need to. Cornwallis was only short, only lost 8,000 men. Britain, by this point, had another 20,000 men in theater, and that did not include the additional troops in the Caribbean. By 1781, Britain was fighting 5 separate nation states without an ally to its name, and it was overwhelmed. Not only was it fighting France, Spain, and the United States, it had dragged the Dutch Republic into the war, and it was fighting the Kingdom of Mysore in India, allied with the French. 5 separate nation states. And Vergennes had managed to keep the rest of Europe out of Britain's corner, which was an amazing feat because he had to deal with European politics at this point. Catherine the Great of Russia was a particularly formidable potential foe. So Vergennes was really a master juggler at making sure that he not only was able to keep the Americans going, but keeping everybody else out of the war and conducting other parts of the foreign policy as well. You can see where the battles were occurring. The Anglo-Dutch War took place in places as far away as the Caribbean and the Channel. The war in Mysore, which was, again, one of the kingdoms in India. Gibraltar alone absorbed 60,000 Spanish troops in a four-year siege. It was the single largest siege in the entire war. That wasn't Yorktown. It was Gibraltar, and it was violent. That's a mushroom cloud you see erupting next to the Rock of Gibraltar. That's how vicious the fighting was. The last major battle of this entire war was, in fact, the Battle of Cuddalore, which took place in India, 6 months after the preliminary peace treaties had been signed. The peace of 1783, there were actually two treaties signed, ended 8 years of war. And during that time, about 200,000 French and Spanish soldiers and sailors fought against Britain. And that's compared with an estimated 250,000 Americans to perhaps 380,000 Americans. They were as invested in this war as we were. America could never have won the war without France. France could never have fought the war without Spain. What I hope all of you take away is this. The United States did not achieve independence by itself. It was, in fact, the centerpiece of an international coalition, born as an international alliance, which worked together to defeat a common adversary. And when you think about who we are as a nation, it's our role even today as the centerpiece of international efforts for the common good that continue to define the United States as the indispensable nation. Thank you.
Why do you think the contribution of Spain, I mean, let's face it, most Americans don't appreciate the contribution of France to our victory in the Revolutionary War, but the contribution of Spain is, well, it's news to me, among others, but why do you think that is so widely overlooked? Or I'm assuming it is widely overlooked.
The earliest histories of the Revolution, which were written while the Revolution was still being fought, do talk quite a bit about the Spanish contribution. Over time, several things happened, the most important of which was the manifest destiny concept. Manifest destiny was to push westward, push south, and who was in our way? The Spanish colonies, Mexico, etc., and probably the person that I identify as probably the most culpable in making that part of the story, not only disappear, but actually he cast quite a lot of shadow, or shade, I think is the current term, on the contribution, was Bancroft, who was the premier historian of the 1800s. And he was very much a manifest destiny champion. And so the role of Spain sort of was written out of the history because, as almost any history, it's a product of its era. And once that happened, the way I saw it, looking through the different histories that had been written from about the mid-1800s all the way through to the really 21st century, you saw very little mentioned. It's only now that we're starting to see other authors start to talk very specifically about the Spanish contribution. And many of my references, I'm very grateful to know the authors and the historians who helped to contribute not only to my direct work, but to the work behind me and to other works that highlight how important that role is And just one or two points to make. Just a few years ago, Bernardo de Galvez, who I mentioned earlier, was given the honorary title of Citizen of the United States by Congress, which is also held by Lafayette and just a few others, including Churchill. And a copy of his portrait was, which had been authorized by the Congress back in 1784, I think it was, but never delivered, was finally hung in the Treaty Room of the Senate. I just had a chance to see it last Thursday, which was great. So little by little, the recognition is coming again. I don't believe in coincidences. I think that it's the fact that we are recognizing that our heritage did not simply start with the Mayflower. The story of America is not the English and English colonists moving from east to west. It's Spain moving from south to north. It's other nations moving in different directions. It's often been said that America emigrated to Spain and not vice versa because we took over much of the Spanish territory. As I said, I have a hard time believing that that is simply a coincidence. Recognizing that this is part of our entire shared heritage is now, I think, critical to understanding who we are as a nation. I hope that answered your question. Okay.
How many countries were occupied by Britain at that time? Question number two, you talked about French islands. Were there others than Haiti, Guadeloupe, Martinique?
It was already, Britain was already starting to expand its empire. And of course, they weren't countries, they were parts of the British colony. So of course you had Florida. So let's, I don't know if I can do the entire litany, but Canada was now a British possession. Florida was a British possession. Britain also had logging colonies in what is today the Belize. At the time, it was for a long time British Honduras. In fact, there were battles fought there. Didn't talk about that. They had interest in South Africa. Of course, the English, the British East Indies Company, which was a wholly owned subsidiary of the British Empire, had its feet and hands and other parts of the British body in India. It was actually a corporate empire as opposed to, it was only taken over by Britain in the 1800s. And parts of what is today Germany were part of George III's personal empire. I always forget the specific term of the Hanover, of Hanover, it was called a, somebody here probably knows. So they had a fairly substantial presence. It was nothing compared with what happened after Britain lost America. One of the essays in the book behind me points out that if you just fast forward a few decades, the real winner of the American Revolutionary War was Britain, because it was already turning its attention away from the American colonies and towards Asia. And it really became the empire, the second empire, upon which the sun never sets. That term was first used, by the way, for Spain, in case anybody wants to look it up. So your second question was the islands in the Caribbean that were part of France. They were, at the time, Saint-Domingue, which became Haiti, Martinique, Guadeloupe, and then there were a lot of islands that just kept going back and forth between Britain would occupy them, then France would occupy them. And they still, by the way, had two small colonies they still have today, the islands of Saint-Pierre and Miquelon, which is right off Canada. And everybody wonders, why did they have these two little cod islands? Was cod that important? No, it was not that important. That was where the French Navy trained its sailors. Most, like every other nation, had a navy whose sailing populace came from the merchant fleet, and the sailing fleet, the fishing fleet, was really the main source of French sailors. That's why they had those islands. Not for the cod. The cod was good, but it was mainly as a training ground. So I hope that answered your question.
You state that France would not have taken sides in an English civil war, but would if the United States was independent.
Sovereign nation.
So you're suggesting that if in the 1770s a civil war like that between the Roundheads and Cavaliers of 100 years previously had broken out in Britain itself, that France would have scrupulously maintained a hands-off attitude towards it?
There were examples during the Second Hundred Years' War where France was allied with other nations in helping to bring down Britain. But certainly at this point with Vergennes, with Choiseul and then Vergennes, the idea of getting into anybody's civil war was off the table. The Seven Years' War was devastating. It raged across Europe. It brought national economies to their knees. The one thing Vergennes did not want was another outbreak of war on the European continent. In fact, there's a part of my book, and I prefer not to go into it in any detail because it would take the rest of our time here, where supplying arms to the Americans was to a large extent a way to keep Spain and Portugal from breaking out into their own civil war, because they were going to do so. So it was not in the cards. If Vergennes wants France to be the center of power in Europe, the first thing he had to make sure was nobody else was fighting. And that's why, if for no other reason, France was not interested in getting involved in a civil war. I hope that answered your question.
They don't have much of a navy, but what is the German and Prussian position in this international situation?
Stay out of it. Next question. No, that was it. First of all, Germany did not exist as a nation. Prussia, Frederick II, Frederick the Great, was one of those people that Vergennes kept managing to hold off. The other nemesis, of course, was Austria. The Austro-Hungarian Empire, and it was a real question whether there was going to be additional outbreak. They had many merchants who were supplying arms, and that was true of the Dutch Republic. In fact, the Dutch Republic was supplying some of the best gunpowder that the Americans had. The Principality of Liège actually was a small nation state. Small city-state was supplying arms, meaning muskets primarily, to the Americans. And we know this from lots of reports. So it had undoubtedly some national governments turning a blind eye, but certainly no direct support. It wasn't in their interest.
Lafayette, my understanding is that during the war, he's very young, fairly inexperienced in European warfare. How is he able to rise to such heights in the American army so quickly, including obviously being promoted over the heads of American experienced combat generals?
So if Lafayette was, just to be clear, we have not met. So if Lafayette wasn't the most important character in this entire story, how did he become so famous? And the answer is, he made a grand tour of America and then he died. And let me show you why this is the case. At the 50th anniversary of the American Revolution, 1824, Lafayette was 70 years old and the only surviving American general. He was never a general in the French army. He was always a general in the American army. And he was invited by the president at the time to tour all of the American states. There were 24 of them, and he took steamboats. Amazing. And it was in this tour that took about 2 years that his reputation as the hero of two worlds was cemented. And that, in the American mind, came to represent the entire foreign, specifically French, involvement. And the famous quote by Stanton, who was Pershing's aide-de-camp during the First World War, "Lafayette, we are here," came to represent that alliance, as if the reason we went to war in the First World War was to memorialize Lafayette. Well, of course, that wasn't the case. That that tour helped to cement it, and then his death just a few years later really turned the key. And I say that because I did an examination of all the references to the words Lafayette or Lafayette in English language books, and you can see that during the war, very few mentions in anybody's books. And then while in the French Revolution he was in exile, Britain actually respected the fact that he stood up for his own beliefs and they talked about him, and then the references to it kind of go away. And then his fourth visit during the Grand Tour, the number of mentions goes up, and then his death in 1834 skyrockets and then plateaus. So as the talent agent, whose name I can no longer remember, said upon hearing the news of Elvis Presley's death, great career move. And that was also true in the French language as well.
Thank you to Larry Ferraro for a great discussion, and thank you to the members of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library for sponsoring this program of Pritzker Military Presents. To learn more about the Pritzker Military Museum and Library, visit us in person or online at pritzkermilitary.org. Thank you, and please join us next time on Pritzker Military Presents.
Visit the Pritzker Military Museum and Library in downtown Chicago. Explore original exhibits on military history, or be a part of a live studio audience. Watch other episodes of Pritzker Military Presents. Find out what's on at PritzkerMilitary.org. Pritzker Military Presents is made possible by members of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library and its sponsors. The views and opinions expressed in this program are not necessarily those of the museum and library. The preceding program was produced by the Pritzker Military Museum and Library.